it's really hot, but more hot air is not what we need. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, it's good to be back with you. We told you last week I would be in California. And I expected to boil when I was out there, and it turned out I got out there, and it was cooler out there than it was here. So, very strange.
Well, I'm glad you decided to come back.
Yes. Well, listen, I love California to visit. It's beautiful. Some of the stuff that goes on is exciting. Sometimes it's a little too exciting, and I won't relate this on the air. You and I can talk about this. There was a very strange man on the corner of Hollywood and Highland, a large man screaming, angry at something, and he was just yelling at people at random, which I didn't want to deal with. So, in any case, it is beautiful to visit. The atmosphere is very lively and colorful, and, you know, it's a great diversity of people. And I stayed in a beautiful place. We took an Airbnb. And ladies and gentlemen, I would recommend that you look into that. If you have to go travel, look into an Airbnb, because I've done it twice. And I've had two very beautiful places. And the people that we stayed with were lovely people. And we had their pool house, which was very nice. Unfortunately, we didn't get to use the pool because we were too busy. But that's what happens. But I was glad to get back here after paying 9.5% sales tax and going into a Popeyes and just getting a regular meal. My daughter and I getting a couple of regular meals was like $24.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Any place where you had to do a sit-down meal, you had $40 invested instantly. We went to a place that here a meal might cost $35, and it was $50. So,
well, that's because you got to pay that $15 minimum wage.
Well, their gasoline, there were places where gasoline was over $4 a gallon. Now, for the most part, it was $3.85, $3.90. But you know what? What's strange about that is California is one of the biggest oil producers in the country, and yet they have $4 a gallon. Why? Well, their fuel taxes are unbelievable. Why is that? Well, a lot of it has to do with environmental regulation. We went to the grocery store to get groceries. They don't give you a sack. You have to buy. You either have to come with or buy a bag. And a plastic bag costs you a dime. And it's not very big, which, you know, I should have remembered, but I didn't. That's the kind of thing you have to deal with in California. And then the drivers are insane. The freeways are insane. And you go downtown, and because of the climate, you know, it doesn't get that cold there ever. In the wintertime, it gets down maybe into the upper 40s. Well, they have homeless villages under overpasses every place. They're just everywhere. If there's a flat spot and you can throw up a tent, there's a tent on it. Now, the cops come by and bust you if you build it on the sidewalk and all that kind of stuff. But there are panhandlers every place there are. It's a real interesting mixed bag. But we ate at some interesting places. My wife is a big fan of an author who wrote a series of books on Harry Bosch, the detective Harry Bosch. And so what she likes to do when she goes is she likes to go around and sightsee and see all these places mentioned in the Bosch books. Well, we ate at a restaurant that was in one of the Bosch books. And in fact, Harry Bosch's ex-wife is killed in the parking lot of one of these places that we ate. Just to show you what kind of fun we had. But it was said they had legendary pancakes. And I can tell you that it's a place called Dupar's. And Dupar's does have legendary pancakes. They're very, very good. So if you go to Los Angeles, go to the farmer's market, eat at Dupar's.
There you have it.
And I didn't. No money changed hands for that endorsement.
Yeah, it did. You paid for those pancakes.
I paid for the pancakes, yeah. And my daughter and I, between, I think our meal was about $54.
At 9.5% sales tax.
And 9.5% with 9.5% sales tax, yeah. That's it.
Oh, my.
So I'm glad to be back in Ohio. I'm glad to be back in Ohio, and what greets me? Rain. But it was definitely hotter here than it was there.
It has been incredibly hot, you know, for late summer going into fall, as we're going to be here in a couple of weeks. This is, but again, Chuck, a lot of people are, right, oh, I've never felt this hot. I'm thinking to myself, okay, you're older than I am.
let's not kid ourselves. This is the way it used to be all the time.
Yes.
We've had a number of years of cycles where late summer to early fall is like late fall and cool, and that's the odd weather. This very hot late, whether you want to call it the dog days of summer or Indian summer or whatever you want to call it, this is just summertime. Highs in the 90s and humidity. Well, yeah. The humidity has been a little bit much this year. I mean, we've probably had more rain this year.
We've had, we're 8 inches.
During the summer than we'd had in like a full year in the past. But be that as it may, it's hot. It's very hot, and I'm glad that you found a little bit of respite, even though there are lots of wildfires still raging out in California, but they're way north of where you were at, I'm assuming.
Yeah, the fires were up north of San Francisco, a lot of them, and some of them were in the Central Valley. I have a good friend that lives in Wyoming, and I was saying something to him about the weird weather we were having. He goes, you should be out here. He goes, there's a haze on everything because if you look anywhere, it's smoky. Because
yeah, I'm sure
they're surrounded. There are none near them, but they're close enough that, I said, are you getting smoke from the California, Oregon fires or someplace else? And he said, yes and yes. Meaning, yes, there were some in Colorado. There were some in Idaho. There were fires in Montana. So, yeah, it's very dry out there for as wet as we are. We're 8 inches over normal here, I think, the last time I heard. They're way under.
Something of that nature, yes.
It's a tinderbox out there. All the anything that's green is right now is brown, unless it's right by unless it's being irrigated. So, yeah.
But you know what? If you really want to make sure that there's plenty of hot air, all you have to do is go to Washington, D.C.
Yes, sir.
And, we're going to be talking about that today because there's an awful lot of hot air that's spitting out from numerous valves. In Washington. This week has been a capital week for those who... Let me just put it this way, Chuck. Sometimes stress and things like heat and emotional stress bring out the best in people, and they overcome it, and they rise above things. And then sometimes it brings out the absolute worst in people. I think this is one of those latter occasions in D.C. because this week... right after we celebrated Labor Day and all of those festivities, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee took up their beginning process of the nomination hearings for the appointment to the empty United States Supreme Court seat that was recently vacated by Justice Anthony Kennedy. And, of course, Justice Brett Kavanaugh from the D.C. Circuit is the nominee for President Trump. And he has been on the stump since Tuesday. But, Chuck, we were laughing off the air, for 3 days full of hearings, he hasn't got the opportunity to say a whole lot.
Yeah,
and there are multiple reasons for that, and most of it is hot air. First and foremost, something is occurring in these hearings that really hasn't in either recent memory or any time in the past that anybody can think of, really taken place. And that is that the hearings have been continually disrupted by people off the street who are coming in, getting passes, going into the Senate Judiciary hearing rooms, and then jumping up and yelling and screaming at the top of their lungs about saving Roe v. Wade and how, women are going to die and our freedoms are going to be lost and we're going to lose our health care if Brett Kavanaugh is appointed to the United States Supreme Court. I mean, it's been rather interesting theater, Chuck. The opening day of the hearings on Tuesday, Senator Chuck Grassley, who's the committee chairman, almost couldn't even get the committee instructions read out because of the number of disruptive protesters. And again, we know that there are a lot of people out there, the Antifa movement, BLM, you name the movements, including some right-wing movements. There are some ultra-right-wing, the Alex Jones types, who have been crashing this thing as well from their own perspectives. But it's stunning, I guess to say the least, the lack of basic civility, respect, decorum, and yes, dare I say it, tolerance that is being shown by the ultra-left during these hearings. I think they had to escort out of the hearing room, and which means that they've thrown them out of the building. And yes, the Capitol Police can do that. They can kick people out of the building for being disruptive or for being a threat. I think on last count, Chuck, they were up to somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 people that they've had to basically give walking papers to. And that doesn't count any of the committee members, some of whom probably should be handed walking papers. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes as well. It's just absolutely mind-boggling, but I know you are a historian of all things that you'll probably come up with or know of some incidents or some time with somebody's confirmation hearing or some issue. And no, we're not going to talk about the time that, what was it, William Sumner attacked someone on the floor of the Senate with his cane.
William Sumner was attacked.
He was the attackee. That's
Preston
right.
Brooks. Preston Brooks from, yes, South Carolina, and Charles Sumner from Massachusetts. And Sumner had made a speech that was in the Senate and had specifically named a relative of Preston Brooks, and it made a disreputable reference to him. And Brooks challenged him and began to beat him with a cane, and Sumner couldn't get out of his desk. And in fact, ripped the desk up out of the floor trying to get up and to defend himself. So Preston Brooks basically caved his skull in, did great. I think Sumner couldn't come back to the Senate for like 3 years or something. Did tremendous. And meanwhile, Preston Brooks, people sent him canes as a thank you. And Preston Brooks died a rather ignominious death of pneumonia within just a few months of it. Meanwhile, Charles Sumner, believe it or not, was the man who cast the deciding no vote in the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson, the President Andrew Johnson.
Wow.
So, there you go.
Amazing, amazing history. So really, that's been the last time we've seen this extent of a lack of decorum. And of course, that's a little bit more... That's slightly more extreme. And I know that during some of the confirmation hearings in the past, there were some minor things. I think during Clarence Thomas's hearing, you know, but mainly more of that was show stuff from the front with the Anita Hill, quote unquote, revelations that really weren't.
Yeah.
And things of that nature.
Well, I was going to bring up Clarence Thomas. Was there more decorum? In a sense, yes. However, there's some theater going on here on both sides, and I'll be quite honest, the chairman of the hearing could easily have simply said, clear the galleries.
Well, absolutely, but he's trying to craft a balance, because,
yes,
and again, because you understand that, and what we found out a little bit later is, this isn't all happening by accident or by happenstance. These disruptive protesters were not the only ones who were in on the game. It seems that the Democrat members of the Judiciary Committee had, over the weekend, when they should have been reviewing documents that they complained that they hadn't had time to review, they had been on a conference call with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, going over and plotting out how to disrupt the hearings and how to work with these outside groups to agitate and try to bring the hearings to a halt and thus derail the nomination hearings for Brett Kavanaugh.
I'll be quite honest, this is a rear guard action.
Majorly rear guard action. If you're down to this, you got nothing left in the bag.
Militarily speaking, a rear guard action is what retreating troops do to fight off the horde that is chasing them while they're in pell-mell retreat. The fact is, the Democrats killed off what was called in the thing called the nuclear option. That the nuclear option was the elimination of the 60-vote cloture vote to get to a nomination vote, and then a requirement, essentially a Senate requirement for 60 votes also
for a
supermajority for confirmation. And the Democrats killed all that off in a fit of pique while Harry Reid was the Senate Majority Leader.
That's right. They did.
And now
it's come back to bite them.
And I remember you and I talked about this when this happened. And they said, they're going to regret this. They're going to deeply regret this. Because I think what they thought they were going to be able to do was reinstate it and take it away whenever they wanted to. And it's sort of like, no, you guys steamrolled the precedent. That was a precedent that goes back to the beginning of the Republic. And essentially, you steamrolled it, and okay, it's gone. I'm pretty sure that's not going to be coming back. And until such time as we get a mixed bag, control of the a presidency by one party and a control of the Senate by another, you're not going to even hear it mentioned again. Because, first of all, people hated it. It was used as a... what's always interesting about that is the Republican attitude was, let's give him his judges. This is what he wants. The people have spoken. They elected him. We need to give him his nominees, despite the fact that they were awful nominees, like, for instance, Elena Kagan, who'd never sat on a bench. Nonetheless, he was given his nominees. And Democrats are always like, the guy's an ideologue. We have to kill him off. You have to come our direction. We're not going to give you your nominees until you appoint one that comes to the left. That's the whole difference here. And you're not... I think those days are over. Now, unfortunately, what it's showing is how terribly, terribly polarized we've become in American politics.
Absolutely.
But that's nothing new. There have always been great polarizations, hence the that little war we had from 1861 to 1865. When those guys in the South basically said, well, we're independent countries now. We don't want anything to do with you. So was there a great deal of polarization then? Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, all you have to do is see the attitudes. And even during that period, there was a lot more politeness between the North and the South than there is between right and left right now in our country. Essentially, it's town versus country. Out here in the hinterlands in flyover country, we tend to be pretty conservative, and out on the ends, the northeast end and the far west, they tend to be far, far left. And they're getting further and further left, as you can see with what's happening in some of these victories of extreme far-left candidates in primaries. Ignacio Cortez being a prime leader, but not the only one. In Massachusetts, a 10-term liberal congressman just got thrown out in favor of a democratic socialist.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Because what they're figuring out is that the core of the Democratic Party is extremely far left. The problem is when you've been nominated as a democratic socialist, do you run to the right to get votes? Now, in some districts, like where Ignacio Cortez is running, it won't matter. They'd elect Joseph Stalin if he was a Democrat, and you know there are Republican districts where they would, you know, they if Attila the Hun was running as a Republican, he would be elected in those districts. So it's not just one or the other, but the fact is that's the kind of polarization that we see. Are there people who are attempting to run down the center of the track? Oh yeah, real close to you. Who might I be thinking of that's really desperately trying to get as close to the center of the track as he can get?
Joe Manchin.
Joe Manchin, baby, down in West Virginia. He recently got a D rating by the NRA, which is hurting him badly.
That and his, there are two photos. They were taken probably about a year apart. But on one photo, here's Joe Manchin in the U.S. Senate standing with Susan B. Anthony list with pro-life, you know, during the march.
Yeah.
And then another photo, less than a year later, he's standing with a pink-shirted activist with a sign, "I stand with Planned Parenthood." Well, that's come back to bite Joe. There are, I mean, you know how close I live.
Yes.
I'm hearing and seeing the commercials. I mean, they are going at him on that particular issue, and they're also going at him on the gun issue. They're going at him on his lackluster support for, well, one of West Virginia's biggest remaining industries, which is
the coal industry. Yeah.
The coal industry. Joe Manchin's is in a world of hurt. And you know, the Republicans know it, and here just about 2 weeks ago, President Trump did a fly-in and had a rally in Charleston, West Virginia. Do you think that that was not targeted at Joe Manchin? It certainly was. You've got centrist Democrats who are, frankly, I don't even know if they recognize their own party anymore, because when they flip on the news or open the paper or they walk into a committee room, they are confronted by members like Cory Booker from New Jersey. And, Senator Booker sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Chuck, he's one of the members who was in the coordination phone call meeting with Chuck Schumer, who has basically decided that he is going to use these disruptions and this lack of decorum and things of that nature as a great way of setting himself up as a inside favorite for the hardcore progressive leftist support for a run for president in 2020. Now, he's not alone on that committee of Democrats who are eyeing this prize, but he's been very bold about it. And as a matter of fact, we're recording this on Thursday evening. On Thursday morning, this was day three of the hearings, Booker starts off, and I'm sitting here, like, I'm live streaming it and things, and I'm listening to it while I'm doing some others, and I spent, 4.5 hours listening today. And honestly, I think I heard maybe about an hour's worth of actual asking the nominee any particular questions that they didn't already just have the answer to and wanted to bloviate about. But Booker gets out there and he makes this big deal because on day two he had brought up these issues with these emails from when Kavanaugh was an attorney in the Bush White House. And there was an issue or a question about racial profiling, and it was based on some cases, and it was a legal analysis that Kavanaugh was giving. And if you go and read the email, it's really not all that big of a deal. But I understand, you know, Senator Booker is African-American, and so that's a very sensitive issue among people of African descent, who are African-American. The idea of racial profiling is offensive to them, and I get that. And I don't necessarily believe that he was wrong in probably trying to seek out and get some clarity on this to figure out how Kavanaugh might rule on the bench when it comes to situations where profiling might be involved. But of course, Kavanaugh, being a good jurist and a smart one, basically said, you know, in the history of the nomination process, no nominee has felt, that it's wise to embroil themselves in current events that may prejudice them in cases that come before them on the bench. And so he very carefully, and he did this both with the Democrat questioners and with Republicans, because, Lindsey Graham, let me not start with Lindsey Graham, but today he honestly, I'm sitting there thinking, which team are you on, Graham? And I realized he's on team three, which is his own little team out there, just doing his own thing. Not sure why he was asking the questions, but it was almost like he became as a attacking of the nominee as some of the members of the Democrat side, you know, your Dianne Feinstein, your Dick Durbin's, Pat Leahy. I mean, you can go down the list of the Dems on
It's called feathering your nest.
Yeah, it's feathering your nest. That's right. But so Booker starts in on this thing. And so today he decides that he's going to become a martyr for the cause. What cause is that? That cause of the liberal progressive left's, we want our way at all costs, and we don't care what where we have to burn things down in order to get that. So he makes an announcement, pretty bold of the young man. First of all, he compares himself to Spartacus, which you should know something weird's coming whenever a sitting U.S. senator starts talking about how this is, like, he feels like this is his Spartacus moment. Now, Chuck, between you and me, I've seen Spartacus. I don't think he's watched the movie.
Well,
because I don't think he understands what a Spartacus moment really is.
Yeah.
I wish we had a clip from Spartacus.
Yeah,
that'd be fun.
Exactly.
But we didn't.
So. I'm Spartacus. Yeah,
I'm Spartacus. That's right. But yeah, so Cory Booker, we know Spartacus, and you're no Spartacus.
Yeah, that it's like the old Pepsi ads. You remember the Pepsi ads when they used to take the movie clips?
Yeah.
And the Roman soldier holding up the bag with somebody's bag lunch, and it says, "I have lunch here." It says Spartacus on it, and it has a sandwich and a Pepsi. And all the guys are sitting around going, "I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus." And the tear rolls down Kirk Douglas's face.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyhow, so Cory Booker is putting on his best Spartacus routine. He's trying to become a martyr for the cause, and so he announces multiple times, even to the point where the chairman Grassley is like, "Are you going to tell us the same thing three or four more times? Can you actually tell us something different?" I mean, it was getting that tense. That he basically said that he didn't feel bound by any rules of the committee. And the Democrats were making this big issue that the chair had made all this document dump. That, you know, they talk about these 42,000 pages that got dumped on them overnight before the hearing. Well, welcome to life. I remember in 2010, Obamacare, which was 3,000 pages, got dumped on people, and they had to vote on it without reading it. All you guys are doing is having to have your staff do a little bit more digging quickly to get you some questions that you hadn't already thought of. But Booker basically makes this big, you know, dramatic announcement that he is going to violate the rules of the committee, and he doesn't care if it gets him kicked out of the Senate. But he's got to do it because he feels it's the right thing to do. It's his moment, Chuck. He is in the best tradition of civil disobedience. He even said this. Best tradition of civil disobedience. He's going to stand for what's right. And he's going to publicly release documents that were marked in front of them committee confidential, which means that only members of the committee and their staff are allowed to see what these documents are, because there might be some issue of national security or government operations that is not public knowledge. Okay? So Booker just basically says, "I'm going to do it right. I'm tweeting these out right now, and you can kick me out." Well, he wanted them to begavel him and kick him out of the committee room, because then he becomes a martyr for the cause. He becomes the progressive left's poster child. It's, "Oh, look at what Cory Booker, look at how courageous Cory Booker was." Well, Chuck, it created a firestorm. I saw on mass media, especially on the socials, people were incensed by this. Yeah, they need to, you know, he needs to be blah, 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 kicked off. He needs to be censured. He needs to be expelled from the Senate. I mean, a couple of my friends were out there actually saying that. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So finally, I go over on Facebook, and there's a couple, three guys getting into it. And, you know, and the rhetoric's getting larger and larger about what they should do to Booker. And I said, "Guys, I'm afraid that's all really kind of a moot point at this point. You see, it seems that when Cory Booker was making this big, bold assertion to put himself to play his martyr card for the progressive leftists who were being kicked out of the room right and left by the Capitol Police, what he didn't realize was that the chairman of the committee figured that this was the direction they were going to go. So earlier than that, before they even started the committee this morning, he declassified all of those documents and put them, and they were putting them up on the committee's website at the time Booker was making this civil disobedience move, which turned out to be a big fat dud." So, sorry, Corey. Good try, but you missed Spartacus by a mile.
A country mile. Yeah.
A country mile. So that's the start. And then, of course, you had Senator Kamala Harris from California, who is not shy about telling anybody that she's wanting to grab the brass ring and become the nominee for the Democrats for president in 2020. And Harris is quite a piece of work. And she showed just how big of a piece of work she is today by going down this line of questioning that everybody in the room was like looking at her like, what? She starts in on, of course, they're all upset because supposedly an ex-Bush administration attorney had vetted the documents before they came out, and that was all upsetting. But then the chairman got up and explained that the National Archivist had basically told them that they have 13 people who work the archives, and it would have taken them 37 weeks to review, redact, and make sure that they weren't handing out highly sensitive information to the committee. Now, this is stuff that would still be marked committee confidential, but it would take them 37 weeks, 13 people full time, to go through all of the documents from the Bush administration because of the custodian of President Bush's records. 37 weeks. But those who were in the Bush administration, who actually, many of them produced the documents, knew exactly what was in them and said, okay, yeah, this go. No, you need to redact that. No, that one's classified as national security. Boom, 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 boom. So the committee got their documents. But the left, oh, they weren't having it. They were all upset. So Harris gets up here and she starts in on this one deal, and she's like, on this one case, Did you talk to an attorney from this firm? And she named this firm that's got like six partners. You know,
six Jones partners Smith, means yeah.
Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe.
Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. Yeah, no, six partners means there's a lot of people in the firm.
That means there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of attorneys in this firm. Did you talk to an attorney from the? And the nominee Kavanaugh just looked at her and said, "I'm not sure. Can you give me a name?" Because it was obvious she was trying to hook him to a certain individual so she could make this kind of like train logic back to something where they were, where Trump's administration and his people inside were puppeteering all of this for Brett Kavanaugh. And it's like, he's like, I really don't know. Are you thinking of someone in particular? You know who I'm talking about. They're like, okay, that was a reasonable request. There are hundreds, and there are literally hundreds of multi-partner law firms in the D.C. area,
John. Oh, absolutely. Oh,
and
my
so
gosh.
She's asking him, what she was hoping to do was that he would throw a name out there that she could grab onto, or, you know, trying to, and what she did was, because he wouldn't do it, and some of the members of the committee and the chairman were like, can you produce a list for him to review, so that he can basically say, yeah, I know this person, and I know that, yeah, I talked to this person about this. But she wouldn't do it. She just basically says, you know, that she basically made it out that he was really not denying that he had done it, when all he was saying was, I'm not sure who or what you're talking about. Can you help me out here by telling me who you're thinking of? Because it's obvious to everybody in the room, Senator Kamala Harris had some name that she was wanting to drop.
That was a bluff, and it was a very poorly run one.
It was a very poorly run bluff.
That's one of those things when you troll for you troll something and you think somebody's basically going to bite on it, and he said, yeah, good night. I've talked to so many people about so many things. You know, you're going to have to help me. And she says, well, I'm not going to do that. That means she can't help him because she has no idea what she's talking about. She made it up. She cut it out of whole cloth.
Yep. Well, okay, whole cloth. Well, the point is, though, Chuck, if you think about it here, it isn't just that she's cutting things out of whole cloth. She's just doing what everybody in D.C. does, and that is run on assertions without any facts behind them. Oh, a source told me that you had talked to attorneys. Okay, so what? Source is wrong. Or If you've got a name, please share it with me so I can figure out what's going on here. And for those of folks who, you know, pay attention to this stuff and are concerned, especially because that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh is being, you know, advanced in his nomination and his hearing. This is on a hearing for confirmation to the United States Supreme Court. Okay. There are some concerns. You know, he was asked, obviously, the standard questions from the left about his stand on how he feels about Roe v. Wade and it being precedent and et cetera. And he answered, Chuck, let's just say it politically. You know, he wouldn't necessarily come out and say that he would defend Roe as settled law, but he didn't necessarily come out and say that he didn't think it was settled law. He tried to thread the needle on the issue, which I'm sure left both progressive leftists and pro-life right-wingers fairly dissatisfied with how he responded.
Yeah, basically.
And frankly, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because I'll tell you right now, if he would make any glimmer of an indication that he might want to revisit Roe and the Roe precedent and change it, he's dead in the water. Because he will lose that 50th vote that he needs on the floor, which is either going to be Lisa Murkowski or Olympia Snow, possibly.
Right, yeah.
And he'd lose them automatically. But at this point in time, he's not putting anything out, and he's not throwing any chum in the water for the sharks to come after him on. And again, it's wholly dissatisfying because you'd like to have situations where these guys just came out and said, you know what, I'm looking at the law here, and I think the law was poorly drafted, and I think the decision was atrocious. And it was based on smoke and mirrors, and frankly, it needs to be revisited. That's what I'd like to hear.
I'd like to hear it, too.
I'm never going to hear that.
Now, there's a good reason why you shouldn't hear it. And that is that the law is supposed to be decided on its merits
as it applies to each case.
As it applies to each case.
Yes, exactly. And, I thank you. I knew that's where I was wanting to head.
So, and yes. As it applies to the United States Constitution, or as the Constitution is applied to that particular law. We all know that Roe v. Wade, we don't know that. We keep talking about Roe v. Wade being the law of the land. It's no law at all.
It's
an interpretation of the Constitution, and it's a flawed interpretation of the Constitution, because what it says is that the 14th Amendment means that a woman can essentially can decide whether or not she's allowed to kill a human being who is temporarily attached to her and dependent upon her for its life, or whether it's part of her body. And the obvious, biologically speaking, and this has been known since well before 1973, biologically speaking, that's an entirely separate human being who's simply dependent upon you for a short time for its life. Right. People will argue that, well, I'd be burdened with taking care of this child. No, you wouldn't. You know what happened to illegitimate children before Roe v. Wade? They were put up for adoption.
Yeah,
and people who desperately could not have children and desperately wanted them would adopt them. I'm old enough that there were lots of kids that were adopted. I don't know their backgrounds, whether it was a case where, you know, someone died. There's all kinds of reasons why kids were up for adoption. Parents were unable to take care of them. There are all kinds of reasons. But nowadays, the argument is, well, I couldn't give the child the life it needed, and it was not the right time for me, therefore I should be able to kill my baby. That's the argument here. So there was never any law passed. Roe was a decision by a Supreme Court, a deeply split Supreme Court. If I remember right, it was 6-3 or 5-4. It's been too long since I studied this, but the reasoning behind it was simply awful, and it was based on nebulosity about "quote unquote" when life began. Well, we know that essentially a separate human life exists from the moment of conception. And by conception, I mean when sperm meets egg and the nuclei meet and recombination takes place, you have a separate human being.
Yes, you do.
With its own unique DNA profile. And that means it's a separate life. Now, the arguments I love is, well, you know that some huge percentage of those embryos don't take. And I'm like, yeah, I'm aware of that. Thank you very much. Why don't they take? Well, this is where we get into this situation where you and I would say, as Christians, they don't take because God has chosen that they shouldn't take. In his infinite wisdom and knowing his plan much better than we know his plan, he has decided that that particular human being. Now, how do the opponents of abortion handle that? They call God the biggest abortionist out there. Well, God does not commit abortion. He does not permit a life to continue. All of our lives are in his hands. That's the problem. The people that reject God want to use him as a lever to move us off our position. Well, thank you very much, but God is still sovereign in those questions. And what the left wants to do, and some people on the right want to move that particular viewpoint out of the public domain. And you and I are saying, and many 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 people are saying, no, you can't do that. It's a legitimate viewpoint that God is sovereign in these issues. And the fact is, the biology points in our direction, not yours. The fact the biology is on our side, not yours. You want to make arguments about people that are incredibly genetically damaged, whether they should be killed or not. And the answer is no, they have a right to life as well. It'll destroy families. To have to take care of them? No, it won't, because there are many, 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 many resources out there. More resources than you and I could list to help families take care of kids who are special needs and probably won't survive very long. And yet they have the right to life, and they have the right to live as good a life as they are capable of living. I wouldn't want to live like that. Well, neither would I. That's a shallow argument. The fact is, I would rather live like that than not live. And why
right,
is that?
Exactly. It's like, okay, the choice was between that and not living at all. Then if you want to pick the not living, then, you know, you're a conscious being. You go do it. If you know, that's your call.
You have that
and
to
I'm
take
not
up.
Not for assisted suicide or anything either.
But. That's right. That's for you to take up with your maker. And I would tell you right up front, I'm against assisted suicide. If you want to take yourself out, you take that responsibility into your own hands. Guys like and I lived in Michigan at the time this was going on, Jack Kevorkian. Let me tell you something. Jack Kevorkian was a weird guy. He
almost goes without saying, but okay, do say.
He did an exhibition of his artwork, and I'll be quite honest with you. I saw some of this stuff, and he's a death cultist, flat out. It was death cult stuff.
That's not necessarily surprising.
No, it really shouldn't be. But the fact is,
I mean, take a look at Kermit Gosnell in Philadelphia, who kept. Examples of the aborted children parts and kept them in bottles in his house.
Bits and pieces, not just whole embryos. Yeah. Bits and pieces, eyes and brains and things. Yeah, and legs and arms and torsos. He was a ghoul. The guy was a ghoul. A lot of these, and there are basically reformed abortionists who have come over to the pro-life side and said they came over because of the ghoulish things that they saw in abortion clinics. People who had become hardened to the fact that they were taking the life of a human being. Now, we got started on this discussion because of constitutionality.
Right.
But the fact is that if you have a judicial candidate who comes out and says, I'm going to take this particular position on on a legal question on a case-by-case basis, he has no business being a judge because he is supposed to rule on the basis of existing law, the Constitution, and the arguments of the case.
Right, exactly. He's supposed to see the judges are not supposed to apply their thoughts to the Constitution. They're supposed to apply the Constitution to the law and see if the law is valid, and then apply the law to the circumstances and fact patterns of the case to see if the law is being violated, and if it's actually being violated in a manner that wouldn't make the law unconstitutional. In other words, you know, you can have double jeopardy or ex post facto laws or laws that were corruption of blood. They would all be
right.
Potentially legal, yeah, but they're unconstitutional.
Illegal
as well if they're unconstitutional.
We need to explain what that means. A corruption of blood is essentially that you not only are you convicted of a crime, but your family loses everything, including their rights of citizenship. And that's normally in perpetuity until the corruption of blood is removed by a legal act. Those things were absolutely forbidden by the Constitution, and the reason they were forbidden by the Constitution was because a number of people who came to the United States came here because they had in the early days, during the colonial period, was because they had worked a corruption of blood against them, and they came essentially as exiles.
Mm-hmm. True. So there are reasons why the Constitution prohibits certain things from happening and prohibits certain types of laws from being made, and it's because we learn from history. And you're right, a judge or a nominee can't be going throwing about their own personal beliefs and views into the mix ahead of time without understanding what the facts of the case are or understanding how that law operates or what the body of jurisprudence around that law has been, the way it's been shaped. Now, does that mean that they have to stick to that? No. They can create new precedent by finding something that is erroneous or finding something that was never been addressed in rulings or in the law itself, and then they can build from that in order to do what I think Antonin Scalia was trying to do, which was get back to a limited originalist interpretation of the Constitution and have that be the guiding force for reviewing the cases they had in front of them, not looking at the cases and trying to cherry-pick a sweet case in order to overturn a constitutional tenet that you just find objectionable for some reason or the other, which is what most of the people who are screaming and yelling in the back of the room are actually asking for. They want activist judges who will at a whim and on the, how they feel about it, to willy-nilly change the course of law in order to appease their desires.
Yeah, in the favor of their particular viewpoint, if you would put in an ideologue that would favor a different viewpoint, well, then he's someone who has to be destroyed. If you think about the problem that you just laid out, think about it in these terms. In Roe v. Wade, we basically have a decision which said, we don't know when humanity starts in a life. We don't know when life begins, and we don't know when humanity applies. Therefore, we must consider the fact that a fetus is not a human being. Would I be off on that interpretation? That's essentially what they said. We don't know when life begins,
yes.
And therefore...
No, that's the original interpretation for the framework for deciding Roe. Yes.
Okay. So one,
and even said in it that if you can determine that that life begins at a certain point, then the whole framework of their decision was cast up
it's flawed and it has to be reworked. Okay, think about it in these terms. I'm going to go back in history instead of forward. I think we've already determined human life begins at the moment of conception. There's no doubt about that. You'll get some biologists, who have a political agenda who will come out and say, no, not necessarily. The beings have to be sentient. That's why you've got, you've got guys out there who are Peter Singer saying things like children should be able to be aborted up to the age of two because they're not self-aware. That
actually,
kind of thing.
Three. It's not just.
Yeah,
three.
Yeah. In any case, three. Go back in history, and we'll go back to a Dred Scott decision. What was the basis of the Dred Scott decision? A black man was not fully human and had no rights that a white man was bound to respect.
Right.
And that's from the words of the decision. You've got the same thing going on in Dred Scott that you have going on in Roe v. Wade. It's a denial of humanity. It's the game that the Southern planters used in order to keep human beings in slavery and to treat them like property. They're not fully human, therefore they can be treated like chattel. And in the case of abortion, essentially the same ruling. You've got that a fetus is owned wholly by the mother. And therefore, she has the right to do with it, since it's not a human being, she has the right to do with it what she wishes. That's the argument. Now, could a legal argument built on biology be made to negate that particular argument on that basis? I think that's obvious. What would that do? Wow, that would create a firestorm. Mm-hmm. Look, yes. There's no doubt about it. As the Dred Scott decision created a firestorm, because there were people who just said you cannot continue to treat human beings as non-entities. You can't. Let's not kid ourselves all the people who were anti-slavery were forward thinkers. They weren't. Many of them assumed that people of color were inferior, which is an absurd notion. Nonetheless, they believed it. They thought that they were backward people who needed to be, sort of taken by the hand and dragged through life. It's a dumb assumption. Nonetheless, it is an assumption, and we've got the same thing going on in the abortion movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same attitude. And the fact is that I'm pretty sure we can make a very good biological case, a very convincing biological case, that life begins at conception. The fact that many of the fetuses die at the 2-cell, 4-cell, 8-cell, blastocele, any number of stages that you can name, notwithstanding, they die for different reasons. Some of them are deeply genetically damaged. It's God's way of saying, nope, we're not going to let that one stand. Sometimes it's something that a mother does by mistake. That she gets near something that's toxic at the wrong time, and the baby would have been born damaged, and so it is allowed to die. Sometimes women never know they're pregnant, have no idea they're pregnant, and they lose a baby. My wife and I lost a baby, and she didn't know she was pregnant. She suspected that something was going on. She didn't know what, and then she miscarried. So, look, these are facts, and we have to be cognizant of the idea that these arguments are probably going to pop up again in a court. And I think some people are going to be surprised at who, if it does come to a court hearing, who's going to vote no and who's going to vote yes. I think they're going to be very surprised that some of the people whose votes they're counting on in the current court, that they're not going to get. And I could be wrong about that. I don't think I am. I'm talking about people who were counted in the conservative camp but have made some majorly odd decisions about it. For the simple reason was it good law or bad law constitutionally? They didn't care. What they didn't want was upheaval.
Right.
And I'll say who I mean, John Roberts. John Roberts basically made noises like he really thought Obamacare was bad law twice, and he didn't upset the apple cart because he didn't want upheaval. That's a real dumb reason. And that's the kind of, that is not the kind of reasoning you want out of a judge. A judge should be willing to make the hard decisions and take the slings and arrows.
Yes, they absolutely should. And for all intents and purposes, and according to what we're seeing, it looks like Brett Kavanaugh is going to make a pretty good Supreme Court justice, because he's, over the last 3 days, he's taken an awful lot of slings and arrows.
Oh,
Chuck.
My gosh, has he taken abuse? Yeah.
Many of them directed at him, but many of them really directed through him toward the person that they all hate the most, which is Donald J. Trump, the president who nominated him. So this really, honestly, this isn't so much about Kavanaugh. This is about changing the face of everything that they've come to know, and I hate to say it, love, about the D.C. malaise, where everything just goes according to plan, and you focus group everything, and as, if you can create enough uproar and offense and you know, disgust and disdain for something, you can force a change and force people to vote the way you want them to. That's changing. We don't have enough time on this program to talk about it, but we certainly need to talk about, and hopefully we can do that next week, the things that are going on right now with trying to discredit the entire Trump administration, because they're getting a lot closer to endgame of dismantling, well, what Trump has called, and we found out he's right, the deep state.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and I wish we had more time to discuss this, because it's important. Because the deep state is basically in the middle of, while the news media is running interference for them, they are basically in the midst of proving that they exist.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
With things like editorials in the New York Times, but we don't have time to discuss that, unfortunately.
We'll talk about that on the next program, because that really is going to take an awful lot of unpacking.
That's like a flower that needs to unfurl. Yeah. The petals need to come out and get in the sun and expand and to come to their full loveliness.
Yeah, indeed. and I would say, with the amount of, fertilizer that's being manufactured in the Senate Judiciary Committee, there ought to be an awful lovely harvest.
Bags and bags and bags of fertilizer, I'm thinking.
It is really bad. I wouldn't ask anyone, friend or foe, to do what I've done, which is sit and listen to hours and hours of the back and forth hot air that has been going on during this nomination process.
We're going to have to get someplace where I can buy you a drink so you can so you can come down from that, you know, that experience. So,
I really honestly went, and I know he probably made a slip, but one of the other things that made me laugh about Cory Booker, other than, you know, his blatant pandering to the left base in order to try to shine his star up for nomination, was that he basically said that we're here in the process of appointing someone to the highest office in the land. Now, he may have slipped. He may have meant the highest court in the land, but I don't think he did.
I think so either.
Slipped the other way, which was an inadvertent truth, that the progressive left finds that the courts, especially the Supreme Court, is the highest place they can go when they want to change the face of this country. Because if they have the control of liberal ideologues on the bench, the Constitution means nothing. The laws as written mean nothing. All that means anything is what the mob mentality wants it to mean at any given time. Why do you think there's so much theatrics and so many people getting thrown out of this committee room? It's actually a signal. They're trying to basically say, no compromise, no peace. If you don't give us a liberal justice for the next one, you haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, I'm going to
basically what it's getting down.
I'm going to break in. What I'm going to say is that I'm to borrow a phrase from the left. They're using a progressive dog whistle.
Yes.
That being said, we are out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.